21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue, it's kind of yellow, you know it's true.
That, in my opinion, is the greatest rock and roll band that's ever been put together. Never met them, never spent any time with them, but I sure do love their music. The Traveling Wilburys. This is 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer is Laura Kortner, and our engineer is A.Y. Warshaw. Welcome back, folks. You know, there are some books that you wish were 800 pages. Well, we're going to talk about a book that I wish was around 1,200 pages. I enjoyed it so much. Goddesses and Every Woman. It's by our guest this evening, Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolen. It was published in 1984. Goddesses and Every Woman, A New Psychology of Women. This book really touched a nerve with the public and became an international bestseller. Thousands of readers learned to identify their own inner goddesses and guided themselves to greater self-esteem, creativity, and happiness, and they learned how to be choice makers in the myths of their own lives. Now, that's a good sentence. Choice makers in the myths of their own lives. And this book shows you how to become aware of the powerful archetypal goddess forces within all of us and how to cultivate them for our benefit. Dr. Bolen based her thesis on a combination of classical Greek mythology with a study of the collective unconscious as described by Carl Jung, and the seven Greek goddesses were introduced as psychological patterns and symbolic figures. We've bought well over a dozen copies of this book and are giving them to our daughters, nieces, and everybody else that opened their eyes, because I believe it's a must-read, not only for all women, but also for all men who want to better understand the women in their lives. Men should also seek out Dr. Bolen's sequel to this book, Gods and Every Man. But our time's pretty limited tonight, Dr. Bolen. I'm going to ask you to summarize this book, and then perhaps we can focus on Athena as our model example to show how you describe each of the seven as a goddess and as an archetype and as a woman.
Well, one premise is that images that have stayed alive in our psyches for thousands of years, like the Greek goddesses, are recognizable because they're essentially patterns. And I was responding to ideas that all women should be alike and that there was only one way to be truly feminine and anything else was somehow not okay. And I drew from the women I knew, the women who were in my practice, the women colleagues, and could see, and in myself, that there are different, there's a diversity in us, and there's a diversity among us. And so there was, first of all, the goddesses that have to do with autonomy and achievement. And they resembled, like, Artemis, the goddess of the hunt, and goddess of the moon. I mean, if you're like an Artemis, you can set your eye on a target and go for it. Very useful when you have a career in mind or a goal in mind or a cause in mind, that you have that kind of focus and that kind of energy, and not all women do. And another one that is also very useful out in the world is Athena, because Athena was the goddess of wisdom in a certain Greek way. She was the strategist. She was armored. She was an intellect. She was also the same kind of mind that can strategize chess or war, can also strategize how to make a pattern to weave on a loom. I mean, it's a very similar, it's a thinking type of quality that also shuts out what people around her might be feeling. Mm-hmm. And then there was a third independent goddess that is virtually invisible, even in Greek mythology, and this was Hestia, was goddess of the hearth. She made home and temple sacred, and yet there were no paintings, sculptures of her. There was no hardly any mythology about her, but she was the first born of the Olympians and greatly honored. in ritual, and she was considered present in the fire at the center of the round hearth. And you see, that's the image I also have as the center of the circle, in the main circle, in a circle with a spiritual center, that the invisible presence. That's why it's so easy to put a candle in the middle of the circle, because it's a natural archetypal form that somehow an image that brings light and warmth to a circle is the presence of this independent goddess called Hestia. Then I looked at the other sides of women and myself, and those that had to do with needing others to be completed, to complete us. And I could see that with all of these, there's a different amount of it in us. For example, Hera, the goddess of marriage, is archetype of the wife. Well, you can see her often, you can see all of these, by the way, often when girls are quite young. The girl who dreams of Prince Charming and is planning her wedding way back when, and is looking at every date she has when she gets to be a teenager as potential husband, doesn't realize it, but she is living out an archetype in which Hera, as the goddess of marriage, looked to a husband as bringer to completion in her ritual. She also married the great philanderer of all time, which was Zeus, and it put her into a jealous frenzy every time he was unfaithful, and he was often, because that was his nature. And it's one of the archetypes that if it's fulfilled, if you marry a man who honors you and honors marriage, and Hera is a major archetype in you, then it does bring you a great deal of meaning and happiness. But if you should marry the wrong man who does exactly what Zeus does, then you find yourself torn up by the rage of this side of this particular goddess. So that's one of them. It fulfills you or it devastates you. And that's the same for Demeter, the archetype of the mother, that if you naturally are a maternal mother person, you started out playing with dolls often and mothering everything when you're a little girl, and your attitude toward marriage may not be like Hera's at all. Hera saw marriage as the bringer to her completion. Well, a Demeter might see marriage as what one needs in order to have a family, in order to have children and raise them in a really good situation. And her passion is her children. And when she can't have them, or when something awful happens to one of them, or when she has an empty nest at the end of those years, she is susceptible to being very empty and depressed as a result. And then Persephone, who was Demeter's daughter in the story of Demeter and Persephone, is the eternal maiden in most of her roles. And she's the compliant mother's daughter. She, as a little girl, is so different from, say, Artemis, who knows what she wants from the very beginning, or Athena, who has her nose in a book. I mean, Persephone kind of goes along with whatever the stronger personality might want. And she often gets into the same kind of troubles that the goddess did. Persephone was abducted into the underworld. And if you wander in life without much consciousness about the risk you take or such things as that, you can be like Persephone, the women who are in the contemporary newspapers for their addictions or their overdoses. The susceptibility to drugs is one of the Persephone kinds of problems. So that was six of them. And the seventh one I put in a category all her own, because she certainly needed or had relationships as part of her definition, because she was Aphrodite, the goddess of love and beauty. And she had a series of relationships, and she had children by them. But unlike the Hera and Persephone and Demeter, who were in their mythologies humiliated, raped, depressed. This was not true of Aphrodite as a myth, as a story of a particular goddess archetype. She chose who she would have, and so that she had that autonomy. And as goddess of love and beauty, she brought this amazing energy, which people know of, that except for the three autonomous goddesses, or virgin goddesses that I mentioned, Artemis, Hestia, and Athena, all the gods and goddesses, all the other archetypes that stand for tendencies in us, were susceptible to Aphrodite's falling in love. And when you fall under Aphrodite's spell, then whatever it is that you were paying attention to before dims as Aphrodite puts you under a spell. And whatever she does, that what you see in her light is beautiful. So she's got a great power of a certain kind.
Yeah. Well.
So that's the seven goddesses that I introduce in Goddesses in Every Woman, and put into three different categories, virgin goddesses being the ones that were autonomous, the vulnerable goddesses that needed relationship to be themselves and complete, and alchemical is how I named Aphrodite, because hers is a two-way kind of a thing. She, if you are an Aphrodite, you are affected as you affect other people, and it's not just you, the lover, but you, the creative person.
Well,
so that's a thumbnail summary.
Well, you know, I especially paid attention to Aphrodite as the creator. Again, there is some important symbolism here. I wish we had a lot of time to talk about this, but we don't. But there's an ancient symbol called the Hex Alpha. The Hex Alpha is a six-pointed star with a sun symbol, or the circle, the dot within it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I visualize Aphrodite, I can see her literally in the middle of this six-pointed star as a balance, as a pivotal point, so that creativity becomes really a key to the existence of the divine feminine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my speculation on this, because there are so many things that I could read in so many levels, and it's just such a wondrous way of analyzing this work. I don't know how you did it. I don't know if it was all rational on your part,
no,
or intuitive.
Definitely wasn't.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it really had to do when the personification of the archetype walked into my office, for example. I mean, I had to be thinking about it, because I had thought about two types of women and had actually begun writing about these two types. And then when a woman walked into my office who was really possessed by the jealous aspect of Hera, it was like seeing the archetype just in full bloom, in a sense. And also, those three that belong in the vulnerable category, they are responsible for the kind of symptoms that women need to know. I mean, it's a way of describing who you are that can describe the shadow or negative aspects that you have a tendency to have, without saying you're sick or you're a patient or you're all a symptom, because you're not. It's just that if you have a certain kind of goddess archetype, you have a tendency to behave in certain ways, and therefore you have a tendency to either have a certain number of character problems, which the virgin goddess, the autonomous ones, can have, or you can have a certain amount of problems that have to do with more symptomatic psychological problems, which the dependent goddess, dependent on other people, vulnerable goddesses feel. And then Aphrodite does fine as a goddess before patriarchy got down on her, before the religions came along and said that sensuality and sexuality in women was evil and bad. And then she became reduced from the goddess who was this awesome golden goddess to the goddess of prostitutes.
Yes.
The dishonoring of a quality in women that made women afraid to be Aphrodite. I mean, it's so dangerous in some parts of the world. You could be stoned for attracting the eye of somebody and responding to it.
Well, even in the United States, in certain parts of our country, you could still be stoned. But when patriarchy is really important here, because how do the goddesses represent patterns that reflect life in a patriarchal culture?
Well, they all do, because after all, Greek mythology arose during the beginnings of Western civilization's patriarchy. And so, like, Athena gets along very well because she's a father's daughter. She honors the institutions. She looks up to the men in power. Artemis, in her own independent way, doesn't clash with, seems to get along well enough, but she goes into her own wilderness areas, whether it's a study area or whether it's the actual woods or athletics or competitiveness or things like that. And Hestia goes into her meditation. She's not going to be bothered by patriarchy. But if you are dependent on relationship, patriarchy has really strong views about who you should marry, how you should stay faithful, how you should not make choices based on your own authentic choice about who you love, or whether you should have children or not. Patriarchy universally in these fundamental religions do not want women to decide whether they really want to have children or not.
That's right.
One of the things that patriarchy does is define women in terms of men's need for them,
mm-hmm,
and fear of them. That's because right. every man has had a powerful woman, his mother, having great power over him when he was little. And that probably goes into how it is that when he grows up, no woman is supposed to have much power over him. And as a culture, that certainly has ended up happening in the more patriarchal ones. Because women are kind of scary. There's their ability to make you forget what it is you had on your mind, because you're drawn to a woman sensually and sexually, and then it's her fault.
Well, of course, you know, it's her fault. There's no doubt about it. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that.
Right.
I couldn't help it. We got to take a break, and we come back. It's all her fault. Always has been. The Bible tells us that, et cetera. We've covered all that with Rian Eisler and so many, but it breaks your heart. It breaks your heart that,
yeah,
when you learned that 150 to 175 years ago, women were not allowed to read a Bible, weren't allowed to own a Bible, and anyone who gave them a Bible was going to lose his job. I mean, this is unbelievable that they actually were discussions that women didn't have a soul. This is ridiculous.
Absolutely.
But it's true. It is true. Most, and you know, it is so embarrassing to be a man at times to understand that we had to dominate another human being, actually discussing whether or not she had a soul or not, and give all the power to her children, especially her male children, but none to her. Whoa, boy, what kind of karma have we created, friends? But I better shut up. And this is 21st Century Radio. Our guest is Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin, M.D. And when we come back, which goddess gets the golden apple? We're going to talk about that one before we move into Athena.
Hello, this is Joanne Shenandoah. I'm a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter, Native American Music Award winner, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
That's Aunt Joanne. Yes, indeed. They got their land back. They received their sacred land back. We just heard from her recently. It's just amazing that the land upon which the League of the Iroquois, Deganawida, Hiawatha, etc. Oh, it's a thrill. So, they're moving up in the world, friends. Okay, I get carried away. Our guest is Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin, M.D. I wish we had four more hours. I probably would tire her out, but I can't help it. It's just wonderful to be able to discuss these things on the air. But, Gene, could you tell us a little bit about the Judgment of Paris and how it's related to the Golden Apple?
Well, in the story, the gods and goddesses gathered at a wedding festival, and the goddess of discord, Eris, was not invited. And so she showed up uninvited, and she threw this beautiful golden apple right in the midst of everybody, and it said, "For the fairest," on it. And immediately, at least three of the goddesses claimed it, you know, said, "It's mine." Aphrodite said, "It's mine." Hera said, "It was mine." Athena said, "It was mine." And so here, there are three powerful goddesses all claiming this golden apple that says, "For the fairest." And Zeus, canny diplomat as he had to be, and actually apparently was, as a figure, he said, "Oh, I can't make the choice. There's this young man, Paris, who is an expert on women's beauty and fairness, and he would know which of the three of you are the fairest." And So Athena promised him victory in any battle that he would enter. Hera promised him the lands of Asia. And Aphrodite promised him the most beautiful woman in the world. And Paris, being Paris, chose the most beautiful woman in the world and started off the first steps that would lead to the Trojan War. But to get back to the judgment, which is what I emphasized, is that in a patriarchal world, the men who set the tone for the culture, and it's either they could decide what women should be like to be acceptable, what women's beauty should qualities are, and women then make all this effort to be pleasing in order to be acceptable, whether in some cultures it meant binding your feet. In most cultures, it means keeping your mouth shut about being smart. But whatever it is, the idea of who gets to choose what part of you develop and who you are is the major idea of, for me, about which goddess in you gets a golden apple. First of all, you had to be able to tell which ones are active in you. And the reason for needing to know which ones are active in you is that they run deep. They are archetypes. It means that life is meaningful. You feel more authentic. You feel like you're becoming who you were meant to be if you can develop the archetypes that you came into the world with. An archetype is sort of like a talent you came into the world with. Well, imagine if you are Athena and you came into a world in which you could not be taught to read and you couldn't go to school. And you have this fine mind that could be easily a rocket scientist in a different culture. That has been true forever in so many cultures to so many women. And then they are treated as if they're stupid because they aren't educated. And the prejudice that already was in the culture just keeps carrying on because, oh, you know, she can't do this. She doesn't know about that. And the fact that it takes such a lot of actual intelligence to run a household and do the agriculture. I mean, in third world countries now, it's women who do the primary work of not only the household, but of growing the crops and raising the animals and things like that. And you've got to have a certain amount of intelligence to do the kinds of things that are required. But what if you never were allowed to develop it? Now, if you are allowed to develop, say, Athena, and that is your major strength, then the more you develop it, the happier you are, because it's like taking your musical, like music. If you have music as a talent and no one ever lets you listen to it or develop your own ability to play or to sing, how sad that would be. And this is across the board. What I think about in Jungian work is to help people to become what is meaningful in them to develop and become.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you which know, goddess gets the golden apple needs to depend on you knowing what's true for you and choosing to develop it rather than becoming what someone else expects you to be. Major thesis was that we are caught between the archetypes that are innate in us, some stronger than others, and the stereotypes or the expectations of, or limitations outside of us. So here we are, caught between these two powerful forces, one from the archetypes, the other from stereotypes or expectations. And when we become conscious of both acting on us, we can make choices that have to do with the path we happen to take.
That, yes. That's, I think that's the most important aspect, making the choices. Well, today, I guess 6-inch spiked heels are the key to a woman's success. I just saw that in a newspaper the other day. Must smash their little toes.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can amputate them, you know.
Oh. I guess. All right. And now, of course, that is it's very understandable what John Lennon was telling us. I'm not going to be allowed to say what he exactly said, but woman is the let's just say, black of the world, or blank of the world. You know what I'm referring to in his song about that? That's what Yoko Ono taught him.
Yeah.
She taught him a lot. No, she did. She really did teach him a lot. He was...
Do I have a moment to say a little bit about a little myth called a procrastinating bed, because it applies here?
Okay, you have a minute.
Okay, if you're on the road to Athens, which is the road that you're put on to success, male or female, you had to pass Procrustes in his bed. And what happened to you is that he put you on the bed, and whatever part of you didn't fit, he cut off. Whack, so much for that. It doesn't fit into this culture and this family. And whatever was acceptable, he stretched like on a medieval rack until you fit. And then, after this process, you continued on the road to success, the road to Athens. Well, whether it's literally cutting off your little toe to fit into 5-inch heels, or whether it's to cut off your assertiveness because it's not welcomed in the world, or for a man to have his sensitivity or his compassion chopped off because it doesn't work on the playground and doesn't work with the guys, that's what happens to individuals who have to adapt or who choose to adapt or just passively adapt to what other people think is who you should be and what you should be.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some questions here that are extremely important to our research, and this deals with using Athena as an example of how each goddess archetype is examined in this book. Now, the value of your book is a detailed analysis of each of the 7 goddess archetypes so that women can really understand each one as it relates to her. And in each chapter, you examine the goddess as mythological goddess, as an archetype, as a woman, and their young, middle years and later years, as parents at work, their relationships with women, their relationships with men, sexuality, marriage, children, psychological difficulties, ways to grow, that was really an interesting area to me, and how to cultivate them. Let's use Athena as our example, because our time is so limited. What aspects of Athena are your favorites to share with our audience?
Well, Athena was, the image of Athena is that she wears golden armor in most of her portrayals with a spear in one hand, but there are other portrayals in which she is not wearing armor, and she has a spindle or a bowl in her hand. So she is a very practical aspect of the feminine, whether it is in the household, being able to plan how to weave something on a loom, a design, or whether it is to strategize how to win an election or a war. The women who succeed on the international scene now are women who have developed the Athena side of themselves along with other parts of themselves. Like, you could not be Hillary Clinton without developing a strategizing mind, which is Athena. You couldn't be Meg Whitman, who is the new head of Hewlett-Packard, without being an Athena. Athena is that ability to think clearly when others are all emotional. And I suppose because she was the only goddess on the battlefield, why it stood out so much, where when all that conflict and testosterone and alpha maleness was out on the field, she kept her cool. She could strategize.
What was it?
I find her difficult because she doesn't operate from the heart. She's not able, unless she develops the ability to feel her vulnerability and then have a compassion for others who are vulnerable. So she's the kind of woman who supports a lot of the kind of politics that make it hard for vulnerable people or immigrants or poorer people to survive.
What would Athena's particular psychological difficulties be?
A lack of compassion, a lack of vulnerability, and a character that does what works. That the potential for a lack of morality or ethics in winning. This is, by the way, whenever I talk about the potential difficulties and gifts, these were our tendencies, and whether they get really developed negatively or positively depends on the family and culture in which they live.
Mm-hmm. Well, what ways would Athena women need to grow?
She needs to develop Aphrodite. She needs to develop the receptivity and vulnerability of Persephone. She would be helpful if she could enjoy the kind of mystical element that Artemis has in the moonlight to see the world as one and beautiful. She is somebody who often reaches midlife and only then realizes that she needs to develop her spiritual and her emotional life.
Okay.
Because she's been so focused on career or success.
One last aspect about her. How does one cultivate the Athena archetype? Because it certainly would be needed.
Well, education is the best way to do that.
Education. Okay.
And to grow up, to be intelligent, to realize one is intelligent is really a very basic beginning place. But so many girls do not grow up feeling that they are intelligent until recently, where things have changed in the United States considerably since the 1970s. You know, there are more girls, young women, going to college than young men. There are more women getting graduate degrees than men. And just 50 years before, there weren't women in most of the major professions. So, again, you have to have a culture or a family that says, we think you're smart and we encourage you and support you to go to school.
And we are encouraged. We're encouraged right at this moment to take a final break here on 21st Century Radio. So pardon me, Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin. Goddesses and Every Woman is the book we're talking about. Powerful Archetypes in Women's Lives. William Morrow, 1984 to 2004. I don't know how many dozens of languages it's written in, but thank heavens it's been written. And we need to thank her for that. We'll be back in just a few minutes on questions dealing with America as Amazon, Minerva, Athena, Liberty Goddesses, and the psychology of the goddess.
I'm Selena Fox. I'm senior minister of Circle Sanctuary, an international Wiccan church based near Barneveld, Wisconsin. And I'm also executive director of the Lady Liberty League, which works for equal rights for pagans and others involved in nature religion worldwide. You are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. And you can learn more about my work at www.circlesanctuary.org and www.selenafox.com.
Way to go, Selena. I love that name. Well, for all kinds of reasons. Well, our guest is Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin, M.D. What a wonderful name. I wish we had time just to discuss the symbology of that. Well, Dr. Bolin, I'd like to focus now on the Statue of Liberty and other depictions of the Liberty Goddess in American iconography. While there is no obvious influence of Athena on the Statue of Liberty, I believe she is the one Lady Liberty that would resonate with most of us out of the seven in your book. She appears without disguise as herself, usually in the form of Minerva, in many examples of official American art, and she made an especially important impact on the design of the Statue of Freedom on the top of the Capitol Dome. We'd like to like you to think about why Athena Minerva was so appealing to our founders, and how the archetype of this goddess influenced our country's direction.
Well, I'd like to say something first about the Statue of Liberty as Lady Liberty.
Yes, ma'am.
Because I do remember the words, "Give me your tired, your poor, your teeming masses yearning to breathe free. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." That is a symbol of our country's compassion that we once had. You know, this is it. This is a country of immigrants. And we stood for the potential of coming to the United States of America and being able to start over again, to be away from the oppressive countries that they came from. And so I remember once on a cruise ship going underneath Lady Liberty, as I call her, into the New York Harbor, and looking up at her, really getting a sense that she... it is a sacred statue. There is something. No wonder we hold Lady Liberty in such high regard. And she got turned into an it. It's not referred to as a she. It is the Statue of Liberty. And I don't know, the Minerva Athena question you asked. Minerva in Rome was, she also had the function of being a kind of patron of the arts, but she's pretty much the same as Athena. There's not much difference between the two, and our country hasn't been able to decide on our symbols. You know, we once had our eagle looking at, there's sort of the war things on one hand and the peace things on the other, and I think we changed its head around at some point as to what it was looking at. And the country is having some major identity difficulties because we seem to have forgotten the basic archetypes that drew our various foremothers and forefathers to this country, and equality and opportunity and a kind of egalitarian democratic beautiful place with lots of land and lots of relationship to nature seemed to be what drew us here. And to have a woman on the top of the Capitol and a woman holding a torch coming into the harbor says something about this being in some way we don't call it a motherland, we don't call it a fatherland either, by the way many countries do, but it has been a very warm, welcoming country, which usually when you think about warm and welcoming, it is a feminine aspect. And we come to a place where the indigenous people were here, were the first settlers, the first people, they're called for the first people up in Vancouver, and we know something about the migration down across the isthmus around Alaska, down into North America, and down to into what is now the United States. And so the first peoples came, and they have had a connection to the land, the indigenous peoples, the circle, to respect for their relationship. They talk about all their relations, you know, the those that fly and those that, you know, the four-footed ones and the two-footed ones and the ones with wings, the respect of relatedness, which is also pretty feminine in if you have to kind of divide qualities, but relatedness, all part of family. Is that sort of what you had in mind?
Well, indeed it is, but I'd like to make a comment on this, and that is basically the media has played a major part, in my opinion, in the confusion that we have and the importance of our symbols. President Eisenhower in 1961 told us about the military-industrial complex. He warned us about it. And 1986, in my opinion, the biggest move was when Ronald Reagan allowed General Electric to own NBC, now one of the greatest polluters on the planet, with $84 billion tax-free dollars alone. These are patriarchal institutions that are powerful, and they do control, and you can listen to our news, and what are we talking about mostly? Entertainment, entertaining people, and pitting one person against another. So I think that's obviously played some part in this. I didn't want to put too much emphasis on that until the, I think it was the New York Times just finished talking about the $84 billion tax-free from General Electric, which is just amazing from that standpoint. But now here's a question you may have never been asked before, Dr. Boland. Using the Statue of Liberty as a focusing symbol, do you think our self-identity as Americans can be transformed by examining for her the important lessons that Athena women have to learn?
Yeah, well, Athena women as a whole need to remember that they have a in her mythology, Athena was the daughter of Metis, the first goddess of wisdom, an ancient goddess of wisdom, and Zeus. And Zeus tricked Metis into becoming small and swallowed her when she was pregnant because he was threatened by her pregnancy. He thought that maybe she was bearing the son that would challenge him and supplant him. So it was sort of a paranoid idea that happens when you are threatened by what you did to your father and what your father did to your grandfather. So in the mythology of ancient Greece, Zeus tricked Metis when she was pregnant, as it turned out with Athena, into becoming small, and he swallowed her. And inside of Zeus, or inside of the patriarchy, Metis gave birth to Athena, who was raised inside of Zeus until she was an adult who was born out of his head. I mean, Greek mythology can be a little bizarre. But he had a splitting headache. And then out of his head came Athena wearing golden armor, landing on Olympus with a mighty war cry, and being from that point on father's daughter par excellence. She was the only Olympian that he trusted with his symbols of power. And this is the role of many Athena bright women. As they come in, they are mentored by a real father or a father figure. They think he could do no wrong. They have a contempt for the feminine in themselves and for women. Up until a certain point, when culture starts to affect them because of the women's movement, and because they start to look around and realize that for all that they were in this favored woman status, truly she never was one of the boys. And she discovers such things as glass ceilings and various other things. A lot of them do, that a lot of Athena women do. And at midlife, there is a realization that what the feminists have been saying all along is true in so many ways. And so maybe first it's studied academically, sort of, because that's an Athena mode. But when she starts to become conscious of being cut off from those positive qualities that are feminine, she starts to, in a sense, remember mother, remember the mother line, remembers the part of her that she has not valued before because she's not valued being a woman, which is sad. I mean, it's like being a person of a different ethnicity in a majority culture, and you end up having disdain for people who are like you.
Well, even in the larger sense, I'd like to tap into your decades of experience as a Jungian therapist on this next question. The Earth Mother was well established in this land before the Europeans arrived. The Native Americans respected nature and renewal, and many lived in matristic or mother-right cultures. The question is it possible that the collective unconscious spirit of Earth Mother of the Native Americans had some influence in an unconscious way on the Founding Father artists and their depiction to this country as a woman?
Well, one could speculate at a number of what you have conquest over is also to be viewed as a woman. So, I mean, you know, it's not all positive. But if you come to this land and you pick up anything of the indigenous, you pick up Mother Earth, Father Sky, and you are related to the great all or the great mystery. And so you allow in a concept that is much larger, and you are then a part of nature and not have dominion over everything. And that is a fundamental difference between indigenous cultures and Judeo-Christian monotheistic cultures. One gives men dominion over nature, and the indigenous cultures respect that we are all part of nature, but we do not have dominion over it all. And I think that is archetypal, yes. That is, and in fact, even in Greek mythology, first there was chaos and then there was Gaia, the earth. I think that in the psyche of all humans, there is an archetypal appreciation for Mother Earth, for the Great Mother, that it's part of the bedrock of the psyche. So when it starts to be brought into culture in a more conscious way, like the movie Avatar, it was an interesting experience in bringing back a sense of connection to nature versus dominion, destruction of nature.
Indeed it was. Dominion happens also to be exactly the kind of thing, dominion over the earth, that the fundamentalists this time in DC 40 and elsewhere have emphasized, that they are in control of the earth. And the earth, as far as they're concerned, is nearing its end because Christ is coming and there's everything else is going to be destroyed after that. Well, now, obviously, we just have 1 or 2 minutes, and let's return to the United Nations Fifth World Conference on Women. There is a petition to be signed. Is that correct?
Yes. If you go to my website, jeanbolen.com, you can hit go petition, a little blue thing, and it'll take you to the petition to sign it, and it explains it there. Mm-hmm. So you can help. You can help the cause by doing that. You can help the cause by becoming aware yourself about what the issues are. And I suggest to people that they respond to the kind of things they move them. For everyone to be an activist on behalf of what matters to them at a heart-soul level.
Well,
I'm calling this heart-connected activism.
Well, it certainly moved me, and that's why we signed it. You know, there was one quote.
Thank you.
One quote from the book that I love so much, it was from the Dalai Lama, that the world will be saved by Western women. He said that in 2009 at the Vancouver Peace Summit in 2009. I want to thank you for joining us, Dr. Jean Shinoda. It's been extraordinary.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
Well, thank you for making this a much better planet. You have done such a terrific job of that. And we'll see you next week. Actually, Dr. Queen Zahara will see you next week, and we'll talk all about children and food and how to keep them together.
You gotta spread the word. Tell them Around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lisa Lucera.